Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Nutritional supplements are a big business. Calcium supplements represent a $6 billion market, but they do not require scientific evidence or FDA approval. For years, doctors have been telling us to take calcium pills to improve our bone vitality and reduce the risk of fractures. But according to a recent meta-analysis, calcium supplements confer no protection. In his book, Building Bone Vitality, researcher Michael Castleman describes what we can do to protect our bones. Later in the hour, Orland Middle School science teacher Jan Matthews weaves a story about changes from childhood to middle age told through poetry. She published her collection of poems under the title Often Overlooked. Michael Castleman says that the calcium theory of osteoporosis, endorsed by leading health experts, is not supported by the facts. He and his co-author reviewed more than 1,200 studies dealing with risk factors for osteoporosis to write their book, Building Bone Vitality, a revolutionary diet plan to prevent bone loss and reverse osteoporosis. Michael Castleman, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Are you going to tell me that TV's beloved Dr. Oz is giving bad advice?
I'm not going to say that anyone's giving bad advice. What I am going to say is that the research on osteoporosis, on dietary approaches to preventing osteoporosis, is not supported by the facts. If you look at the studies, there have been 147 studies of nutrition as it relates to fracture risk, osteoporotic fracture risk. And what you find is that the more calcium people take, it does not save their bones. If you look at the worldwide epidemiology of osteoporosis, you know, Americans think that if you just live long enough, you're going to get osteoporosis, that it's a function of aging. That's not the case. The osteoporosis rates around the world vary substantially, with very high rates in the United States and Western Europe, and very low rates throughout much of Asia, Africa, and South America, places where people eat a lot less calcium than we eat. In fact, the countries in the world that consume the most calcium have the highest osteoporosis fracture rates. And so to say that calcium is the key to preventing this disease is just simply not supported by the facts, by the research.
Well, you know, I was curious, okay, how do Americans typically get their information about taking care of their bones? What is their source of information? So I thought, well, Dr. Oz, I mean, people like him, so I Googled to see what he had to say. I typed in Dr. Oz on osteoporosis, and sure enough, there it was, calcium, eating dairy. And so then I Googled and looked at what WebMD had to say. I thought, well, maybe that's where a lot of people get their information, and hoping that maybe their researchers were a little more meticulous than Dr. Oz, because I know he doesn't do, he has people research to the information he's going to present, but they're all, they don't agree with you, Michael.
That is correct. Yes, we are voices in the wilderness, my co-author and I, although our voices are getting more traction. If you read the osteoporosis literature, medical literature, as we did, and we reviewed 1,200 studies for our book, among osteoporosis researchers, it's generally a developing consensus that calcium just doesn't really work, and what works is a near-vegetarian diet. And the reason that Americans are so resistant to this is that wealthy countries, if you look at the United States and Western Europe, they're wealthy countries. They eat a diet that's very high in protein, meat, dairy, fish, cheese, milk. And protein, as you may know, is made up of amino acids. And so when you eat a lot of protein, those amino acids get broken down, the protein is broken down in the gut into its component amino acids. Those amino acids enter the bloodstream, and when you pour acid into the blood gets slightly acidic. But the blood cannot be slightly acidic. The blood has so many functions in the body, it has to maintain a very specific pH. And if the blood gets at all acidic, the body has to neutralize it. And just like you take Tums for an upset stomach, that's calcium to neutralize stomach acid, the body reaches into bone, pulls out calcium, puts it in the bloodstream, and that neutralizes the acid from the protein that you've eaten. So basically, if you look at the worldwide epidemiology of osteoporotic fractures, the people who eat the highest protein diets have the most osteoporotic fractures, and that's the United States, Western Europe, and a couple of other countries, Israel, Australia, New Zealand. But America and Western Europe, basically everyone believes that being affluent gives you carte blanche to eat as much protein as you want. In fact, Americans absolutely worship protein. People will tell you, oh, I need to get more protein.
And if you're rich, you eat steak.
Exactly.
And a big one.
Once people become affluent, once cultures become affluent, they stop eating beans, they cut down on the vegetables they eat, and they eat a lot more protein. And when they do that, they not only develop more osteoporosis, but they also develop more heart disease and cancer. This is simply a function of the saturated fat in high-protein foods and the fact that they're eating fewer fruits and vegetables, which are the best sources of antioxidant nutrients that help prevent osteoporosis and cancer and heart disease.
But you know what? You're the only one calling it a theory. Nobody else calls it a calcium theory of osteoporosis because it's accepted as fact.
That is correct. We have a
They don't feel it needs proving.
We have a tremendous blind spot in this country as far as the hazards of eating a high-protein diet. And even though about 5% of Americans are vegetarian, I should add that I am not a vegetarian. I am. I do eat a little bit of
but
meat.
But your co-author is.
Yes,
she's a vegan, in fact.
My co-author is a vegan, but I am not. In order to pursue optimal health, to reduce your risk of cancer, heart disease, osteoporosis, diabetes, obesity, and Alzheimer's disease, you don't have to absolutely be a vegan. But you want to make sure that you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables. And I get about 6, 7, 8 servings a day, which is up there. The typical American now eats 2.5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And the most popular vegetable in the United States is French fried potatoes, which are dripping in fat and which increase risk of cancer and heart disease. So this country has done a terrible job of educating its citizens about what's actually good to eat and what is good for their health.
But we're led to believe that the reason we have a problem with our bones is we have a calcium deficiency, and you're saying we have a calcium imbalance.
We have a calcium imbalance. Americans are told they have to get at least 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day. Well, in Asia, people eat less than half that and have an osteoporotic fracture risk about 1/4 of ours. Once you look at the worldwide epidemiology, it is clear that calcium doesn't matter. And actually, even if you look at studies in the United States, your listeners may be familiar with the Nurses' Health Study. This is a study that's been going on for 25 years that has tracked 90,000 American women nurses. And in one of their sub-studies, they followed 18,000 women. Oh, no, they followed the 90,000 nurses for 18 years. And they've assessed their calcium intake, and they found that calcium intake made no difference to their osteoporotic fracture risk. And what did make a difference was things like how many fruits and vegetables they ate. The more fruits and vegetables you eat, the more alkaline nutrients you put into your bloodstream, and those alkaline nutrients neutralize any protein you eat so that the body does not have to reach into bone and rob your bones of calcium so that your bones can stay healthy.
My guest is medical journalist and novelist Michael Castleman, and he is co-author of Building Bone Vitality. And we've been talking about the fact that we've been led to believe that the problem with our bones is a calcium deficiency, and he's saying that no, we need to maintain our blood pH within a certain range if we're going to keep our bones healthy. You know, though, but what about children? If we're raising a little one, we want to make sure that their bones are strong, and so we want to make sure they drink their milk, and you're saying nope.
Well, my co-author, Amy Lanoux, who is the co-author with me on Building Bone Vitality, her specialty is children's nutrition and health and children's bone development. And her research shows that shoveling milk and cheese and yogurt into kids doesn't strengthen their bones. It really doesn't. And that children's bones are pretty much like adult bones, that the more alkaline nutrients you get when you eat in your vegetarian diet, that's good for the body. And, you know, human evolution really argues in favor of our point of view, because humans are the result of 30 million years of evolution from the great apes. And the great apes and all of our evolutionary ancestors subsisted on a diet that was largely fruits, tubers, seeds, nuts, very little meat. Some meat, you know, they would scavenge a little bit. They would kill small animals and eat them. But overwhelmingly, they ate a vegetable diet. And that is how our bodies evolved. We've had agriculture as human beings for only 10,000 years, which is a blink in the evolutionary eye. And it's only since the development of agriculture that people have actually eaten a lot of grains and raised domesticated cattle and farm animals for meat and milk. So basically, we have Stone Age bodies, but we're living in the Space Age. And our Stone Age bodies really want to eat in a Stone Age manner, which is largely fruits and vegetables and a little bit of meat, and not having McDonald's for breakfast, Burger King for lunch, and Pizza Hut for dinner.
Well, there's even a diet called the Paleo diet, which says what you're saying, actually.
Yes, I'm a very big fan of all of the research into Paleolithic diet, which not only shows that ancient humans ate mostly fruits and vegetables, but it also has analyzed the type of meat that they ate, which they did eat meat. And the type of meat that our ancestors ate was nothing like the meat we eat. It was a lot less fatty, and the composition of the fat was a lot less saturated. And it is saturated fat in the diet that is causing heart disease and cancer, and it's all the protein in the diet that is contributing to osteoporosis.
You know, one thing I liked about your book, too, you said you looked at these studies, because sometimes you pick up the newspaper and you see this headline that catches your eye because it says oysters can prevent osteoporosis. I don't know. That's rather shocking. So I look at it and then found out they studied five people. And anyway, the study was pretty much worthless.
Yes.
And so it really didn't deserve much credibility. So what you and your co-author did was look at these different trials and see which ones were credible and which ones you could pretty much discount because they either didn't have enough people participating or for whatever reason, it wasn't a very valid trial. And so you looked at the ones that had the most credibility.
Yeah. One of the problems with medical reporting in the United States is that everyone focuses on the study du jour. The latest study somehow is the definitive study and cancels out all previous research. In fact, science, life is messy, and studies are all over the map in terms of their methodology and how they're set up. And so the only real way to get a handle on what's happening is to look at all the research, and that's what we did. We looked at every single study of diet and osteoporosis risk since 1975 when the medical literature became computerized and easily searchable. And what we found is the consensus is that the more fruits and vegetables you eat, the stronger your bones. Now, you can measure bone mineral density in women, and you can feed them calcium, and you'll get a slight increase in bone mineral density in about half the studies. If you look at, there's about 300 studies of this, and about 160 of them show, yes, you get some increase in bone mineral density. But if you look at the same, if you take the same approach and look feeding women fruits and vegetables, then you find that they get improved bone mineral density in about 85% of the studies. And so fruits and vegetables increase bone mineral density better than calcium does. A fruit and vegetable-based diet decreases risk of osteoporotic fracture much better than calcium does. And even calcium and vitamin D, you can get calcium and vitamin D. The best studies show that it reduces fracture risk by about 30%. But there are plenty of countries on Earth that people don't take calcium, don't take vitamin D, and have fracture risk that's 75% lower than ours without all the calcium and vitamin D, simply eating a more primitive, early human, vegetable-based, fruit-based diet.
But, you know, it's so logical that if my bones are made of calcium, then I just eat more calcium. But you're saying that that's really not the case either, and you gave the example of a brick wall
Correct.
Without mortar.
Correct. Yes. Calcium is one of 17 nutrients in bones. There are 17 nutrients in bones, and you need all of them, not just calcium. Basically, bones are like a brick wall, and the calcium is the bricks. The 16 other nutrients are the mortar. What makes a wall strong? Well, you have to have decent bricks, but you better have a lot of mortar between those bricks, or else the wall's simply going to shatter. What the dairy industry has done, given its influence over the USDA and the ranching industry too, what American health experts say is that just pile up the calcium. Well, that's just like piling up loose bricks around a wall. It doesn't give you a strong wall. It just gives you more bricks. You have to get the mortar in there, and the mortar is 16 other nutrients. And where are those nutrients found? Overwhelmingly in fruits and vegetables. The only way you can get all 16 of those nutrients is to eat fruits and vegetables.
My guest is medical journalist and novelist Michael Castleman. He is co-author of Building Bone Vitality. And if we want to call yours a theory, this low-acid theory of keeping the blood pH low-acid, you mentioned in your book that this low-acid theory of osteoporosis was first put forth 40 years ago, an article in The Lancet in 1968. And I was familiar with this idea for years. I mean, so it wasn't new to me. But the problem is it hasn't been publicized. I mean, the researchers say, okay, we found that. Now let's go back to our lab, and we're happy there. And you're outside the lab saying, no, wait a minute. The whole world needs to know what you're saying. And you waited around, I guess, and said, well, I guess nobody else is going to do this. So you and your co-author decided, okay, we're going to write this book.
Yes, I'd been writing magazine articles about the low-acid theory of osteoporosis prevention for several years. And in fact, that's how I met my co-author, because I read her research and I thought, oh my God, this is great. Here's a researcher showing that milk and dairy don't even help children's bones. Started talking, and I interviewed her for several magazine articles. And yes, this theory goes back to 1968. It was fully articulated 40 years ago. But, science is often trumped by politics and money. And in this country, the meat and dairy industries are hugely influential in Congress, hugely influential in the USDA. And Americans in general have been bamboozled by their own wealth to believe that, you know, we have the divine right to eat as much steak as we want. Well, you can eat all the steak you want, but there are consequences, and there are health consequences. And the more high-protein, high-fat foods you eat, the higher your risk of cancer, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and now we know osteoporosis.
You know what I think that you put doctors perhaps in kind of a delicate situation is, if I'm a doctor and I've for years have been telling my patients, eat dairy, eat cheese, drink milk, and all of a sudden you're coming out and saying, no, that's wrong advice. I would hate to face my patients again and say, you know what, I've been telling you wrong all these years. Now you really need to change, forget what I've been saying before. So I think maybe that's one part of the reluctance. But I've also heard that the way you get a new theory accepted is wait until everybody who believed in the last one dies off, and you get a new generation of scientists, or in this case, doctors, and maybe that's where the hope will come, because they will be more open perhaps to this way of looking at it. So I think maybe that's part of it. And I also wondered if maybe your wife, as a physician herself, when she would come back from a convention and say, Michael, do you know what they were saying at this convention? You know what they were telling people about osteoporosis? And I can imagine she was in the background cheering you on, saying, please write this book.
Well, my wife is a doctor, and she has to take continuing medical education seminars. And during the writing of the book, she took two of them. And both of them had an update, women's health osteoporosis updates. And the first one she went to said, calcium, calcium, calcium. And she came home, and I was rolling my eyes. But the second one she went to, the woman said, yes, calcium. But you know, there's this other idea about acid diet and fruits and vegetables, and we should all be encouraging our patients to eat more fruits and vegetables for prevention of cancer and heart disease. And now it looks like that helps with bone health too. So the low acid theory is slowly wending its way into medical education. And things do change. You know, it wasn't until the mid-1970s that cardiologists encouraged people to exercise for their hearts. Until then, exercise was considered, you know, optional. Now, of course, it's malpractice for a doctor not to recommend exercise. So I believe that slowly the truth does win out. But in the case of osteoporosis, we are up against enormous vested interest in the cattle and dairy industries. And they wield tremendous power in Congress and in the USDA. And so the only way that this that Americans are going to learn that that a high-protein diet is bad for bones is from the bottom up, for people to educate themselves. And I hope that they will read our book, Building Bone Vitality, as part of that process, because the leadership, in my view, is pretty much bought off by the vested interests. And so for the truth to win out here, people have to become more familiar with the research themselves and not be bamboozled by the meat and dairy industries who are saying, just get your calcium.
My guest is medical journalist and novelist Michael Castleman, co-author of Building Bone Vitality, a revolutionary diet plan to prevent bone loss and reverse osteoporosis. And we've been talking about diet, but there's another component of what you recommend, and you were talking about cardiologists now know to recommend exercise. And so what you recommend is walking. What
yes.
could be simpler
yes.
than that?
Well, there's absolutely no controversy over the fact that weight-bearing exercise, walking, dancing, gardening, are absolutely crucial to bone health. Our book, Building Bone Vitality, focuses on the dietary elements of bone health because that is controversial. But there is no controversy over the importance of weight-bearing exercise, and even people who advocate high-calcium diets are banging that drum too. So what it comes down to is 30 to 60 minutes a day of walking. That's all. That's what you need to do to maintain bone health. And it doesn't matter. You don't have to have weights. You don't have to walk in any specific way. You don't have to get involved in any kind of, you know, crazy walking regimen. Just walk. Just move. Or dance or garden. Just put weight on your bones. Because bones are kind of like muscles. To develop your muscles, you have to use them. And to develop your bones, you have to put weight on them. They have to feel a little stress of everyday life. And this also comes right back to our evolutionary past. I mean, 30 million years ago, the great apes walked great distances to find fruits and vegetables to eat. And now we don't have to do that. All we have to do is walk up and down the aisles of Safeway. But walking is fundamental human exercise. It is part of, I mean, walking upright is what one of the things that makes us human. And we should really do that because it's very good. And it's necessary for bone health and all health.
You mentioned dancing, and I like the fact that also in your book you recommend yoga.
Yes.
And for example, for strengthening wrist, for wrist strength, then that walking might not strengthen your wrist. But you do say, you make the point that the real danger is hip fracture, and
correct.
That's what puts people in nursing homes, and
yeah.
that's what cost us as a country billions of dollars is hip fracture.
Yes. Well, I love yoga. I do yoga 3 times a week. And things like plank pose and Vajrasana are wonderful for building wrist strength. And you can get osteoporotic fracture of the wrist, of the ankle, of the spine. But the one that is the real public health problem is hip fracture. Hip fracture is what puts people in nursing homes. Hip fracture is what kills women. Hip fracture is what costs us billions and billions of dollars a year. And so from a public health point of view, preventing hip fracture is the mission of osteoporosis control. And to prevent hip fracture, walking is what does it.
Well, now we've been talking about your book about bone health, Bone Vitality, your book, Building Bone Vitality. And you have to be meticulous to make sure everything is accurate. And I think maybe that's why being a novelist appeals to you, because with a novel, I think when you write your novels, there is certainly truth in them, a lot of truth in them, but then you get to have fun. And you have you have several novels. But your most recent one is called A Killing in Real Estate.
Yes.
And I love that title is great.
Just came out.
It is a brand new book. It's a mystery. And usually when people talk about a killing in real estate, they mean making a lot of money. But in this case, it means also a real killing. Your novel, this new novel of yours, takes place in San Francisco, where you live. So I'm Yes. sure there was a lot of truth that you just gathered from knowing what it's like to live in San Francisco.
Yes, Killing in Real Estate takes place in the Mission District of San Francisco, which is a rapidly gentrifying area of the city and one where there's a tremendous amount of real estate action. And in the novel Killing in Real Estate, a real estate writer for the local paper is murdered. And his friend, who is another writer for the paper, winds up investigating this murder and learning some seamy, nasty things about the great city of San Francisco. It was a lot of fun to write. And yes, there are facts in novels, but the great thing about novels is the facts should never get in the way of telling a good story. And since I made my living by, you know, meticulous medical journalism with, you know, millions of footnotes and everything, I mean, we did 1,200 studies for building bone vitality. It's so refreshing just to be able to make things up. I love it. Writing novels is a lot of fun.
Why don't you read us a little bit from your latest novel, A Killing in Real Estate by Michael Castleman.
Ed ascended the creaky stairs and turned the antique key of the old bell built into the door. It echoed, but there was no answer. Ed rang again, then knocked. Nothing. The door had a stained glass window, maroon and blue. He peered in, but couldn't see much. He pulled out his phone and called, voicemail again. He tried the door, locked. He rang again and knocked harder, silence. This made no sense. Duffy should be setting the table. Where the hell was he? Why hadn't he called? Ed descended the stairs and gazed up at the house. It was considerably larger than his place, a lot of house for a divorced dad with kids only on the weekends. Could his friends have stood him up? Ed doubted it. Duffy always emailed if he couldn't make poker or lunch, not to mention that Ed was doing him a favor, reading his grandfather's scribblings. Ed climbed back and leaned close to the stained glass. Like an old photo in a chemical bath, an image slowly emerged. The foyer led down a hall to the kitchen, where Duffy should be cooking. But Ed discerned no movement. To the right, an arched entry led into the living and dining rooms. Nothing. Ed was about to dismiss Duffy as a thoughtless jerk when, through the dark glass, something on the living room floor caught his eye. A foot, perfectly still, heel on the floor, toes pointed toward heaven.
And this is Michael Castleman reading from his novel, his newest novel, A Killing in Real Estate. And the guy that you follow in this book is named Ed Rosenberg. He's the one you were just talking about.
Yes.
And I was wondering if there isn't a lot of Michael Castleman in Ed Rosenberg.
Well, of course, there is a lot of me in Ed Rosenberg. But actually, Ed Rosenberg was a real person. He was a childhood friend of mine who died young. And I've sort of memorialized him by naming my protagonist after him. But Ed Rosenberg in the novels is a washed out history professor who drifts into journalism and winds up writing a local history column for the San Francisco Foghorn, which is the big newspaper, at least in my fictional world. And he's married and he has two kids and he's like a regular guy. And he's got the problems that regular people have, like his house is too small, but he can't afford a bigger one because everything's so expensive in San Francisco.
Because it's San Francisco. Yeah. Well, for a fun read, Michael Castleman's A Killing in Real Estate, and then his other book that we've been talking about, even if you just pick up the book without even reading the book, if you just pick up the book and look at the cover, it says, warning, calcium pills don't work, dairy products don't strengthen bones, drugs may be dangerous. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you for having me on.
After a break, local poet Jan Matthews shares memories of childhood to middle age from her poetry collection, Often Overlooked. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Orland Middle School science teacher Jan Matthews writes poetry under the name J.E. Matthews. She graduated from University of California, Davis with a B.S. in avian science and later earned a teaching credential at Chico State. She's been writing since childhood and has now published a collection of her poems entitled Often Overlooked. Each poem tells a story with vivid descriptions to give voice to quiet places. Jan Matthews, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you have as your title Often Overlooked. And I really like that title because I think it's kind of a, I don't know if it's a challenge to those of us who read and think, what am I overlooking? What can she point out that I might be overlooking myself?
Well, as a teacher, it's very, very easy to overlook a student's talents. And growing up, I was the student who was a good student. And that put me in a group that was very easy to overlook because it was an expectation for me to be visible. And so when I did something special, it was just acceptable.
Uh-huh.
So titling this book the way that I did is I wrote it for myself to remind myself that I am easy to overlook at times and at other times, not so much.
Well, one of your sections in your book, you call it Little Voices. And it was these kind of divisions in your book are like poems in themselves. And on this page, you're introducing a new section in your book, and it says, Little Voices, the small are often overlooked. If you listen, you can hear them clearly.
Yes. It takes a certain kind of listening to hear or to see the things that one might often overlook.
And even the cover of your book, I looked to see who took the photograph, and was it you? Did you take this photograph?
It was me.
Well, describe the cover. Describe that photograph for us.
So out bird watching, very foggy day, and a tree. And there was something in the tree that most of the people out on the trail had walked right past.
Had overlooked.
So there's a great horned owl hiding in the tree there.
And if you just glance at the cover, you do not see him, because he's the same color as the branches on this shrub or tree that he's hiding in. And I wondered if people, they have your book for a while before they even see this delightful creature hidden in the cover of your book.
I hope so. It was fortuitous to come up with this photograph. I had come up with the title and didn't have a vision for any sort of photo on the cover. I had thought about, words. Because it's a book, so words. And going through my photos, I thought, I have this great idea. And it I think came out quite nicely.
Yes, it did, because we have this surprise there on the cover of your book. Now, we were talking about birds, this owl, and you majored in avian science.
I did.
And I was wondering, I thought it was called ornithology.
Well,
what's the difference?
Well, at an ag school, avian sciences focused mainly on meat and egg, poultry production. So I took a lot of classes about eggs and chickens and turkeys, and I was fortunate enough to work with a couple of graduate students on their program, their projects. And so I worked with the cockatiels, and I worked with some orange-wing Amazons in some mostly reproduction, looking at what you could do for the pet trade to increase return on your investment with those birds.
My guest is J.E. Matthews, Jan Matthews, and she has a collection of poetry called Often Overlooked. And you write under J.E. Matthews, and I'm using Jan because I assume your friends know you by that name.
They do.
What did you have a reason for selecting initials, or you just didn't want to divulge whether your gender or...
It was actually both of those things. Some of the poetry in here is deeply personal, and it had been written only for myself up until the time I pushed the publish button. So having a little bit of ambiguity as to who I am was attractive to me when I decided what was going to go on the cover.
Because I noticed some of your poems, you're not quite sure, is this a man or a woman's voice I'm hearing when the person is talking in the first person? And you're wondering, well, is this a daughter, a mother, a father, a son? Not that there are any of those, but you do
have to read
the poem.
I love that you pulled that from it. I think that most people, when they are writing, write from several different places, and some of them are genderless. So I think there's some that are very obviously female. I'm very obviously female, and I'm comfortable with that assignment. But I think it's great to have questions. And if even just changing my name from Jan to J-E can inspire questions, I think that's fantastic.
Well, I think we can probably guess, those of us who are women, the gender of a poem that you call Chores, a Meditation. And I particularly like the title. I really, besides liking the title of your book, I like the titles of your poems, Jan. They were so well chosen because I think some poets just, they're interested in the poem and the title may be an afterthought. But I latched onto that Chores and Meditation because I have a friend who can't believe I enjoy things like washing dishes or folding laundry. Because I think that's...
I believe it.
It's not something that most people enjoy, but it is. I say, no, this is very meditative. And so that's what kind of what I was expecting when I started this poem. Oh, it's going to be how I feel when I fold laundry. And it wasn't quite that.
It might have been titled a rumination as well as a meditation.
Okay. Well, let's read. I'd like for you to read Chores and Meditation.
Absolutely. Here we go. Chores, a Meditation. Laundry languishing, meandering and moldy, waits in the washer. Dogs dancing for food. Nails click on hardwood floors. I bow to their bowls. Particles settle. Every surface is covered. Dusting seems futile. With children and pets, getting floors clean is like vacuuming the beach. Overwhelmed, I leave. Escape to the grocery store. I forget my list. But we need ketchup. I aim for the condiments, hypnotized by rows. Rows, shelves, and aisles. Everything is in its place. The order calms me. I wander and choose many things not on my list. Hurry to check out. I drive across town, treat myself to a mocha, head back to the house. Counter is loaded. The unwashed dishes thwart me. Bags go on the floor. Making order here. Unloading calisthenics. Things are shaping up. Dryer is humming. Entropy no longer reigns. I forgot ketchup.
This is Jan Matthews, J.E. Matthews, reading from her collection of poems, Often Overlooked. And I couldn't help a chuckle of recognition that the very thing you go out to shop for, you forget.
That is indeed the case many times.
I don't know how often I go to Costco for something necessary and I end up getting home with a pair of jeans and forgetting whatever it was that I thought I was going to go get.
Well, but those jeans needed to come with you, right?
That's right. I didn't know I needed them. So this brought a chuckle, I said, of recognition. And a friend of yours mentioned that when she reads your poetry, it says, Jan's poetry has made me laugh and cry at the same time. And I think that's a compliment.
I think so, too.
To your poetry.
Well, thank you for passing that along to me.
So that one amuses us because we recognize, the kitchen counter is overloaded with unwashed dishes. I just put the bags on the floor. Or the dogs are dancing around. You hear their nails on the bare floor, the click of their nails. But you do have sad poems. And I noticed that some of them were different kinds of sadness. And the one that had sad in the title, The Smell of Sad, was kind of bittersweet. It was not the sad that, why don't you read it, The Smell of Sad, Jan?
I'd be glad to. The Smell of Sad. Cookies baked, but not for me. Buttery sweetness inhaled as I enter our house. And a note. Went to see Joe. Baked oatmeal chocolate chip. Home soon. Her scent. The hat she left to me, because I always like how it looked. So whimsical on her head. Breathe in her essence, part sweet, part sweat. No perfume, just her soap and her skin. and try to hear her voice, her laugh, lurking in that scent. Sniff deeply. A glimpse of her smile blurs and fades. Baby toes, fresh from a nap or a bath, warm and little, sweet and new, so yummy and perfect. Almost a taste in my nose. Clings and stays, puts time on hold. Those toes grow, covered all too quickly, by booties, soon shoes, and too fast into high heels. Holding your breath won't keep, save, preserve that aroma. So I breathe in greedily, without shame, to memorize it, so I will recognize it, should it return again.
Jan Matthews reading The Smell of Sad, a poem from her collection, Often Overlooked. And just, again, the title of that, The Smell of Sad, because I know happiness has, there are smells that make me feel happy. And this one, it's not sad in the sense of hopeless kind of sad.
No, it's more of a longing.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you know the person speaking is going to be okay.
Yeah. I can make my own cookies. I have the hat. And I have that little girl. I don't have those toes anymore, but I have my little girl.
Well, in contrast to that one is one called On Seeing Her. And we don't know from this title that it's going to be a sad story. And it may, for some people, if they've never had a similar experience, it may be not that sad. But I think those of us who have had an experience like this are really touched by this poem. So would you read On Seeing Her?
On Seeing Her. The laughter had left her, her giggle gone, her face similar to the one I knew, but now waxy and still, not smiling, not sad, resting, but not asleep, there on the couch. I did not touch her, seeing was enough. I knew her skin would be cool and unyielding, and I didn't need to feel it. I stood with her husband, her sister, and son, when the men came to take her. Kindly they moved her onto the gurney. I had said my I love yous, my goodbye, while her eyes could still see, her ears could hear. I know she is dead, yet I gasp and lurch forward when they cover her face with plastic.
Poet Jan Matthews, reading from her book, Often Overlooked. This poem was called On Seeing Her. And you said you chose to use initials partly because some of these poems were quite personal.
Yes.
And I wondered when I read that, that sound so real that I wondered if this was taken from your own experience.
This was very much taken from a personal experience.
And then I wondered, too, well, maybe it was your mother. You said, I stood with her husband, her sister and son, when the men came to take her. Because sometimes you refer to somebody who is your mother's husband, and you don't say, sometimes you say father.
Correct.
But so I was wondering, was this an older woman? Was she your mother?
No.
Or a friend?
Hi, Mom. It's not about you. No, this was a dear friend and colleague who had been ill for quite some time, and I had fallen into an advocacy role for her with her family. And got a call in the middle of the night that she had passed. And this is about 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting with her family and waiting. So, yes, it was a firsthand experience. And this is one poem that I have struggled with because there are parts of it that don't feel real enough to me. So it's really wonderful to have the feedback that it feels real. But that pull that I felt when they covered her face with plastic, it's one thing to put a sheet over someone's face, but my whole body said she won't be able to breathe. There was a very visceral experience for me.
Your body reacted to that.
It did.
And I've known a couple of instances where a man who lost his wife couldn't bear to stay in the room. I'm assuming because he thought when my husband died, he said, do you want to step out of the room when they came to put my husband on the gurney and put the plastic, zip up? And he, I think, must not have been able to bear staying in the room with his wife when they took her away because he that was his question to me. But I did want to stay.
It was important to me to stay.
Yeah, it is very hard.
It is. And some of her family members did leave. And mm-hmm. part of my advocacy job was to be there and ensure that she was cared for with kindness and dignity.
Yeah, I noticed that word. You say kindly they moved her onto the gurney.
It was, so. They were amazingly kind.
Well, you have one more kind of, not one more, but more than that, but one more that I was going to ask you to read, because it's sad in a different kind of way, but it's part of nature. And you teach in Orland.
I do.
You live in Chico.
That's correct.
So you have a commute, and it's a commute where you have an opportunity to observe birds. And the poem I was going to ask you to read was about a duck. And when we first start reading it, why don't you just read that? This is, you give the a name that people might not recognize that this title is a duck. And what is the title of this poem about the duck?
This poem is the Latin name for the pintail duck, Anis acuta. Alone on a gravel path, difficult to identify at first, one wing visible and askew, with your legs crossed unnaturally, head thrown back, twisted oddly, as if you'd seen something behind you, but too late. Your plumage soiled, skin tattered, entrails visible, tangled with feathers, skin and dirt, bluish bill gaping, a silent warning to the rest of your flock. Don't stop here. In life, you were a dabbler, always floating, paired off with your mate. Did you know you were the male and she the female as you bowed into the water, grazing, dipping, and sitting up? Did you know you were the flashier sex, your white chest and fine tail? No fanciful questions in your native setting. One red-brown eye on either side of your head. Did you see everything as flat, two-dimensional? Or did you think profound thoughts about choices and costs? No, this odd kindness bestowed upon birds, no capacity for deliberation, never saddled with ethics, instinctual actions lack planning, a design without depth, no thoughts, so no regrets. So was there meaning in your avian life? The nature of the questions this or that, east or west, this mate or that one, boiled down to eat or be eaten, an answer of sorts in each impulse, in every reaction. One such choice left you here alone, amid the rubble, so beautiful, even in your brokenness. Bolt with the flock or stand my ground. You must have had good reason. I will leave your body here so that your life might matter in case you are a warning to the rest of your feathered congregation. Don't stop here.
Poet Jan Matthews reading from her collection of poetry, Often Overlooked. And this is in one section of your book. How did you organize your poems?
I had a whole bunch of them, and I printed them all out and made the yes pile and no pile.
And the ones that made the cut and the ones that didn't?
The ones that are still being digested and produced. And then they just sort of ended up in an order, and it became very clear to me that there were four sections that had something in common, and this one fell into its section. It wasn't about little voices. It could have gone in little voices, but it was more, I thought it fit better into recycling. Than into little voices. So making those, I feel like the book has a flow. It has a very definite beginning, middle, and end. And in the middle are these questions, the recycling questions, the beginning, the middle has aspects of the beginning and the end in it as well. And that's how this ended up in this section.
Well, this poem is about and I'm guessing you probably came across a dead duck.
I did.
and that your description in the beginning, you're saying one wing visible and legs unnaturally crossed, head thrown back, was probably the way you saw this duck. And there was one line that jumped out at me. So was there meaning in your avian life? Because we all, that's one of the basic questions we have as human beings. What is the meaning of life? And then I wonder about the internal life of animals.
I wonder often. And I make up stories.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
especially
so,
dogs.
So he was, of course, dogs. So this duck was, what was he doing? What was he thinking about? Was he not paying attention? How did he get gotten? And that's curious to me. And why that one duck and not the whole rest of the flock? And did he get to serve as a warning? I hope so. I hope there was a meaning. I hope that there was a reason.
That his fellow, his compatriots, his cohort recognize, uh-oh, there's a lesson there. I better watch out and not stop where he stopped.
Exactly. I think that oftentimes humans talk about leaving their mark. And writing a book is a way of leaving a mark. Teaching students is a way of leaving a mark. Raising my own children. The challenge is to recognize the other markers that have been left for me. And sometimes a dead duck might make me look around a little bit. Like, what ate you? Is the sun going down? Is something going to come finish? So recognizing those markers, be they biological or otherwise.
And you wonder how much self-awareness this duck has. Does he know that he was the handsome one? That he had the flashy feathers? Did he realize that, because he can't see himself, you suppose, and the female duck, his partner, maybe not as this. Her feathers aren't as flashy as his. And so you raise these questions about how self-aware is a duck?
I don't know. I liked the chance to make up a story for him, though.
So you write about birds, and you are a bird watcher. You are a kayaker.
I am.
And you can do those things at the same time.
I often do.
And you say you also you like sitting and knitting. Those can be done at the same time.
Knitting and bird watching are mutually exclusive. Those don't go well together.
Yes, but the sitting and knitting.
The sitting and knitting.
Or kayaking.
Or the kayaking.
Bird watching. You have a poem in your book entitled The Forest. And one of the lines in this poem is about choices made without a map. And we don't have time for you to read this poem, but it did intrigue me because I'm thinking that's the way life is. We very often have to make choices without a map.
We do. We do. And there's some magic in that and some danger and sometimes a tremendous amount of clarity. If you listen to that little voice that says, that's the path. Just do it. That's the path.
Yeah, you say, you conclude that poem, The Forest, seized by fear, realizing the magnitude of work I've yet to do, of past effort, of work wasted, of choices made without a map. And so we are, I find inspiration in your poems, Jan, that, you got to make choices. You don't have a map, but there are choices you have to make and do your best to make choices without a map.
Sometimes a map is helpful, and sometimes it's unnecessary.
Well, I wondered if you have more poetry, or maybe you write in other forms besides poems. Do you have another book underway?
Well, probably. It'll be a ways down the road. I don't have a map for it. Mostly what I'm writing right now is lesson plans.
Yeah.
So, but do be on the lookout. There will hopefully be another one sometime.
My guest has been Jan Matthews. She writes under initials J.E. Matthews, and she lives in Chico, but she commutes to Orland and teaches science to middle schoolers in Orland. It's been such a pleasure talking to you and reading your poems, Jan.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It's been my pleasure to be here.
Under the pen name Professor Shane, Shane Weissman visits schools in the North State and reads from his book Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales. But Professor Shane's nursery rhymes can entertain adults as well as children. He spins grown-up humor into many familiar children's stories. Here is Shane Weissman, a.k.a. Professor Shane.
Long ago and far away from Nancy's bookshelf here today, when proper genealogy, like heritage or pedigree, was as important at the time as being in the royal line, before there were so many kooks, when there were earls and even dukes, causing barons many hassles, finding stones for fancy castles, lived one sad girl very poor in a cottage with no door. It really was a potting shed with a thatch roof painted red. It was drafty and quite small, two tiny rooms without a hall, but that didn't bother her. She just wanted one nice fur, so she could be warm at night, plus she could be a pretty sight to gentlemen and other blokes who made her the butt of their jokes because her puppy had no muzzle. Yes, we're speaking of Rapunzel. Things for her start getting worse. First, some pauper steals her purse. Next, she's charged with causing damage to her landlord's garden cabbage. Without a purse to pay the fine, the landlord made her do some time. For 50 years and half an hour, she got locked up in his tower. How could that landlord be so mean to this nice girl he's seldom seen? Now she cries, what is the matter? The landlord's taken down her ladder. Now her only visitor, who used to come and talk to her and make her laugh and bring her food, can't get to her. That seems so rude. But wait, her fencil has some tricks. He throws up notes attached to bricks. This way they can have discussions about why she gets concussions. Who is this kind and handsome man who throws up hams and racks of lamb? His face is kind, he goes by Vince, and once he even was a prince, but since his hair was never combed, because of that he got dethroned. She had no room to exercise, and so that food went to her thighs. Now through the window she could squeeze her elbow out, but not her knees. Boy, she really needs reduction. Her only hope is liposuction. After 10 or 20 years, long hairs grew out of her ears, and after 40 years or so, age caught up with Vince below. His ancient arm got tired too, and though he tried, his throws won't do. He hardly gets up any food, which puts her in a rotten mood. At least this way, our aging Vinny is helping her to get skinny. Now she'll fit through that window and can complain to Vince below. He sees her face. Come down! But how? She really started thinking now. Then she thought, I'm such a dope, I'll braid my ear hairs. Grab a rope. She grabbed that rope but could not grip. Her earwax rope made her land slip. She landed on Vince with a thud, and both were driven deep in mud. Rapunzel's gone, and so is Vince. There's nothing left but fingerprints. What is the moral of the story? Trim ear hair before it's gory.
This is my guest, Professor Shane. His real name is Shane Weissman, and he's reciting. He's not reading. He's reciting from his collection of nursery rhymes and tales, Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales. Thank you, Professor Shane. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Michael Castleman, author of Building Bone Vitality. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.